Giving his defense before this Jewish crowd, he shares with them that Jesus had actually met him in that temple years before, and in a trance, Jesus had actually told Paul to leave Jerusalem and to cease trying to share with the Jews. And we see why in verse 18. Because they will not accept your testimony about me. Jesus even tells Paul in that same vision that he is to go far away to the Gentiles. A lot of times the Jewish audience thought in terms of the faraway Gentiles are to be avoided. The faraway Gentiles are not to be welcomed in the temple. They bring elements of defilement. But here Jesus tells Paul there in that temple that he is to go far away to the Gentiles. Very similar to Acts chapter 1, verse 8, where we are told to go far away to all the nations. Well, the Jewish crowd reacted pretty violently to these statements and began to tear off their cloaks and throw dust in the air. They began to shout, "Rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live." Verse 24, the commander ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks and directed that he be flogged and questioned in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. Now remember, the commander was responsible for maintaining the peace there in the city of Jerusalem, especially around the temple complex. That's his responsibility, and he needs to know what's going on. He'd love to know exactly why the crowd was so upset with Paul. And so he gave Paul the opportunity to share with the Jewish crowd. I'm sure he did that in part so that he could maybe figure out what Paul had done to make this crowd so angry. So he gave Paul the opportunity to speak to the crowd. I'm sure he thought in his own mind, now I'll find out why this guy had caused such a stir. But if you remember, when Paul stood there on that tower, or on the stairs up to that tower, he spoke to the crowd in Aramaic, the language of the people. Now, I'm sure the commander knew some of that language and he gathered some of that, but truthfully, a speech in Aramaic didn't help him as much as he had hoped it would in order to figure out what this guy had done to cause such a stir. And again, the Roman commander is responsible of maintaining the peace. And so to get to the bottom of this would have been invaluable. So his next strategy was to take him back into the barracks and beat him in order to get the information out of him that way. We talked last week about this practice of scourging or flogging someone. It's in essence a practice of the Romans to beat the truth out of a prisoner. Now, it was illegal to use this method on a Roman citizen. But for all others, it was standard procedure. Verse 25, as they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, "Is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who has been not even been found guilty?" It's a good question. In fact, that question stopped the whole procedure that was taking place there. This is actually the second time that Paul has invoked his Roman citizenship to get him out of a scrape. If you remember, when we looked at the city of Philippi and Paul's events there, in the city of Philippi, he had been taken in custody, he had been beaten, he had been put into prison throughout the night, and in the morning, the city officials sent word to the prison that Paul could be released, but Paul says, "No, I'd like a formal apology from those city officials that authorized this beating of me and this imprisonment of me, because I am a Roman citizen, and that action against me was not. In fact, remember in the story when we looked at it back in Acts chapter 16, he got that apology. And they were very frightened that they had treated Paul the way they had, not knowing at that time that he was a Roman citizen. So he got that apology. Well, let's go back now to our story for today. Acts chapter 22, verse 26. It says, when the commander heard this, when the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. What are you going to do? He said. This man is a Roman citizen. The commander went to Paul and asked him, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Now remember, at this point, the commander had no idea who Paul was. In fact, if you remember, when he was first taken from the mob, the Roman commander thought that he was an Egyptian revolutionary. And when Paul told him he was a Jew who had grown up in Tarsus of Cilicia, the Roman commander had to rethink his approach to Paul. He assumed that Paul was one of the Egyptian revolutionaries that had been active in the city in the years before this. Tell me, are you a Roman citizen? He asked. Yes, I am, he answered. Then the commander said, I had to pay a big price for my citizenship, Paul replied, but I was born a citizen. Now, Roman citizenship could be obtained in a variety of ways. First, it could be awarded to someone for service to Rome. Secondly, you could purchase the right. And that fact, that came up later in the history of Rome, where in order to raise funds for whatever Rome was trying to do, they began at times to sell Roman citizenships to raise money. And the third way was to be born into a family that possessed the privilege of passing on citizenship to their children. Now, the Roman commander, and we said his name was Claudius Lysias, he actually gained his citizenship the second way. He probably purchased it during the reign of Claudius. You know, Claudius was one of those emperors who was known for selling citizenship in order to raise money. That's probably why this commander's name was Claudius Lysias. He was honoring Claudius, from whom he had purchased his citizenship. But we discover in this story that Paul actually gained his citizenship the third way. This was probably the highest level of citizenship that could be gained, the most significant level of citizenship, to be born into a family who had the privilege of passing on Roman citizenship to their descendants. Now, we don't know a whole lot about Paul's family history, but sometime in the past, Paul's family had rendered a significant service to Rome and was granted citizenship and granted the right to pass on that citizenship to their descendants. The Roman commander, Claudius Lysias, didn't seem to have that privilege. He had just simply purchased his citizenship, probably didn't have the privilege of passing it on to his children. In fact, as they stood there, this Roman commander and Paul, I'm guessing that the Roman commander was a little envious of Paul. He had a higher status of Roman citizenship than he had. Verse 29. Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. And the commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizenship, in chains. When I see that little phrase, withdrew immediately, the image that comes to my mind is what I often see in watching high school sports. I don't watch a lot of college and professional sports, but I watched the high schoolers play. And one thing that's always humorous to me is how on the soccer field or in the basketball field, they'll get up real close and they're engaged in good competition and in there and doing the best they can. But if any of there's what perceived to be a foul, there's a dramatic jumping back and throwing their hands. I didn't touch him. Jake's here, Alice is here. They know what I'm talking about. It's this idea of showing the ref that they're free and they're clear. They didn't do anything wrong here. So when I think of the Roman soldiers and the Roman centurion as they're discovering that Paul is a Roman citizen, they probably backed up and threw their arms up like, I didn't do it. Can't call a foul on me. It says in chains. This was actually also a mistake for a Roman citizen. A Roman citizen would only be put in chains after he had rightly been convicted of some crime. Now, Paul had not rightly been convicted of any crime. He had done nothing wrong. In fact, he was the victim of mob violence there in the court of the Gentiles. And the Roman troops from the Tower of Antonio had come down. They had rescued him from the mob. They didn't know exactly why. They were still trying to figure that out. So why had they put him in chains? Well, we had mentioned already that their initial thought was that Paul was an Egyptian revolutionary, so maybe that's why they put him in chains. Obviously, they did not know and take into consideration that he was a Roman citizen. Now, the Roman commanders, we've mentioned already, didn't know the charges against Paul. And now that he had discovered that he was a Roman citizen, he could not beat that information out of Paul. So he has to figure out, what else can I do? What other avenue do I have of answering this question? What has this guy done to cause such a riot? So the thought comes to his mind, hey, listen, I'm going to use the Jewish Sanhedrin. Maybe they can help me. Again, based on the little that he knew, and maybe after hearing a little of what Paul said from the stairs there, he discerned that this was obviously a theological question. There wasn't really criminal activity involved, but it was a theological question. So he decided, listen, how about I will have Paul stand before the Sanhedrin? Maybe that would be the way that I can get some information from these Jewish theologians on what exactly has Paul said or done to cause such a reaction from this crowd. Now, the last time we talked about the Sanhedrin was during the trial of Stephen, Acts chapter 6 and 7, where Stephen had to stand before the Sanhedrin. We also saw the Sanhedrin back in Acts chapter 4 and 5. In chapter 4, it was Peter and John who stood before the Sanhedrin. In chapter 5, the whole group of apostles were brought before the Sanhedrin. So the Roman commander is thinking, I will call the Sanhedrin together. Maybe that would be the avenue by which I'll get some information about this apostle, Paul, and what he's done there. This also raises another interesting question. Romans, as Gentiles, were not allowed to enter into a meeting of the Jewish Sanhedrin if that meeting took place there in the temple. Gentiles were not allowed in the temple complex. In fact, if you remember from our story, this is kind of how this all started. Paul had been accused of bringing a Gentile into the temple proper. That's the whole background of this. So the Gentiles really couldn't go in there. So what happened here? Well, there's a couple different thoughts people have had. Maybe it was a meeting in the Tower of Antonio and that the Roman commander was inviting the Sanhedrin for an informal or hearing type of meeting inside the tower. It's also possible that they were meeting outside the temple proper. Josephus, we've mentioned Josephus before, significant Jewish historian of the period, noted that the Sanhedrin actually met just west of the temple proper. They were outside the inner part of the Jewish temple. Again, this is the area that was of concern. This is the area that Paul had been accused of bringing a Gentile into. In fact, if you remember when Paul was, the riot first took place, the gates all around the temple proper were shut in order to keep out this riot or this stir, or keep Paul out. Let's pick up our story now. Verse number 30. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. Again, the commander did not fully understand all the charges against Paul. And the previous day, Paul had spoken in Aramaic from the Tower of Antonio. We can assume, for the benefit of the Roman commander, that Paul will now address the Sanhedrin in Greek. So Paul will now stand before this Jewish authoritative body. And by the way, Paul will stand in the very exact place that Stephen stood more than 20 years before. We've made the connection between Stephen and his time before the Sanhedrin and now Paul. And remember, back 20 years, Paul was there as well. Paul was actually on the other side. He was on the prosecuting side. He was there accusing Stephen with the other members of the Sanhedrin. Now Paul is switched roles. He's standing in defense. He's having to answer to the Jewish Sanhedrin. So this is where we'll pick up Acts chapter 23. Acts chapter 23, verse number 1. It says that Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." Look straight at that Sanhedrin. I wonder what he was looking for, looking at. My guess is he was looking at people he may have known. Again, remember, Saul of Tarsus had been part of the inner circle of Jewish leaders at that time, and he's probably looking through the crowd. Are any of my old schoolmates here? Remember, Paul had come to Jerusalem as a young person and studied under Gamaliel. He was part of that inner circle of Jewish leaders at the time, and he's probably looking across the Sanhedrin, seeing if he can recognize anyone. And then Paul begins his address before the Sanhedrin. He says, my brothers. Now, this is not the traditional way of addressing the Sanhedrin. This was an official court. How are you to address the court? Well, if you remember, the Apostle Peter, who had also stood before the Sanhedrin back in Acts chapter 4, he addressed the court in the more traditional way. If you remember from Acts chapter 4, Peter said to the court, "Rulers and elders of the people, great deference, great politeness to the court." So why isn't Paul using the same language? Why is Paul standing up there and seeming to be very casual and saying, "My brothers"? Well, I think the answer is real simple. Paul doesn't regard these individuals as his superiors, as his judges. In Paul's mind, they're more his equals. Again, 20 years before, Paul was part of that inner circle of Jewish authority in Jerusalem. In fact, if you recall, when we looked earlier in the book of Acts, it was the high priest at that time, Caiaphas, who had given Paul special permission and authority to go to Damascus to arrest the followers of Jesus. Paul was acting under the authority of the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem. It's believed that Paul actually may have been some kind of an apprentice or a junior member of the Sanhedrin back at the time of Stephen. In Acts chapter 26, when Paul tells his testimony the third time, he talks about how he himself cast his vote in the stoning of Stephen. So Paul looks at this group of people, sees his peers, sees people that he had gone to school with, sees people that he had worked with so many years before. He had studied under Gamaliel, the greatest Jewish teacher in Jerusalem. So Paul, here it is, 20 years later, says to this group of Jewish leaders, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God and in all good conscience to this day." Put another way, what he's basically saying is, "Brothers, I have lived as a good citizen before God." That's a key phrase here, before God. With a good conscience, we could say a clear conscience. What's implied here? What's implied here is that Paul understood that he had God on his side. And if Paul had God on his side, that implied as well that the Jewish leaders were not acting in accordance with God's will and God's knowledge. And so Paul is saying, in essence, I, with a good, clear conscience, with God as my witness, with God on my side, I have done what is right. I have been a good citizen. Again, if that's how Paul's message is to be understood, that God is on his side and it's not on the side of these Jewish leaders, this would actually probably explain a lot of what follows. Now let's go on to verse 2. "At this, the high priest Ananias ordered that those standing near Paul strike him on the mouth." Ananias didn't like Paul's attitude, didn't like Paul's stand here. Let's give a little bit of background on Ananias before we go on with our story. We've already talked in the Gospels how the high priest during the time of Jesus was Caiaphas. Also, Annas is mentioned in the Gospels. He is one of the people before whom Jesus stood trial. Annas was the high priest before Caiaphas. So Caiaphas and Annas were high priests during the time of Jesus. But who is this new guy, Ananias, who's the high priest during this portion of Paul's life? Well, according to Josephus, he was one of the very worst of all the high priests. Extremely cruel, extremely greedy. It's said that he actually demanded that all the tithes that were given to the priesthood were to be coming to him, and that he would handle the funds. He was also very pro-Roman in his sentiments. Again, Josephus tells us he was the very worst of the high priests during this whole time period. He served as a high priest from about 47 AD to about 59 AD. He was appointed by one of the Herodian kings, and then in 59 AD, he was deposed by King Agrippa. Later on, in 66 AD, he was actually murdered by a Jewish uprising. In the mid-60s, there was a Jewish uprising, and a lot of the zealots, Jewish revolutionaries, if you will, had enough of Rome. And there was a revolt against Rome, and ended in 70 AD when the Jewish temple was destroyed. But in 66 AD, the uprising had begun, and one of the first people that the Jewish zealots went after was the high priest. Why? Because he was so pro-Roman in his sentiments. He was so true. He was so full of greed. And he actually was, during the uprising, hiding in a Roman aqueduct there outside Jerusalem. And the Jewish revolutionaries found him and put him to death. So Ananias was not a well-liked or well-received high priest by the Jewish population generally. We see here in our story that Ananias ordered that Paul be struck on the mouth. Now remember, Paul had not, at this point in time, been formally accused of a crime. He had not been found guilty. And to be struck on the mouth very much was an offensive action in that situation. This is not even considering his Roman citizenship. Just as a person being on trial before the Sanhedrin should not have been treated this way. Another interesting thought to keep in mind is the parallels between this particular story and the story of Jesus before the Sanhedrin back in the account of the Gospels. Acts chapter 18 talks about Jesus standing before the Jewish Sanhedrin. And at that time, the high priest, Caiaphas, had ordered that Jesus be struck in the face by one of his officials. How did Jesus respond? How does Paul respond? Well, let's first talk about Paul, and then we'll come back in a moment and review how Jesus responded. How does Paul respond by being struck in the face here in the midst of his hearing? Verse number 3. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed tomb, or you whitewashed wall. You sit there in judgment according to the law, yet you yourselves violate the wall, the law, by commanding that I be struck. Don't you like that image there? I found that image as I was pulling up images, and I said, that's a great one. That's a great one. You see the indignation in Paul's response. Paul was pretty upset. Paul wasn't happy about how he had been treated here in this formal setting in the Jewish Sanhedrin, how he'd been struck in the mouth. Well, again, let's now go back and compare that with the reaction of Jesus, who experienced a very similar situation with Caiaphas, and look at that in comparison to Paul's reaction. Paul obviously failed to follow his master's example. If you remember in the story of Jesus, Jesus did not revile in return. He did not respond in a way that was violent or striking back. Paul doesn't follow the example of Jesus. Paul asked God to strike the high priest. And in essence, he is actually calling down a curse against Ananias. God will strike you, Paul says, you whitewashed wall. Now this image of a whitewashed wall, that's a very powerful, vivid image. Jesus actually uses a very similar image when he's talking about the false Jewish leaders and the false teachers in his time. He actually uses an image of a whitewashed tomb to talk about the hypocrisy of the Jewish leaders and the Jewish teachers. The whitewashed tomb, what's the image there? Well, again, Jesus uses that image. It's the idea of the whitewashed tomb. It's very bright. It looks good on the outside, but we know what's on the inside of a tomb. It's bones. It's the defilement of dead bones. And so Jesus uses the image of a whitewashed tomb to talk about the Jewish leaders, how on the inside they have the defilement of dead bones, but on the outside they look good. The same image actually also comes from the book of Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapter 13, the writer Ezekiel uses a whitewashed wall or a white plastered wall as an example of what not to do, or an example of the false leaders and the false teachers of his time. What's the image here? Well, here's the idea. The idea is the actual wall has very little structure. The actual wall is weak and easily crumbles. But instead of repairing the wall, instead of doing repairs on that wall so it's a sound structure, some people would just cover it with white plaster, make it look good. I had a similar experience to this myself several years ago. We had hired someone to build a deck for us in our backyard. Now, before we had the deck built, we had actually ourselves made some walkways. We had torn up the backyard, and I went out and bought the cheapest wood and didn't even treat the wood. I just made these little walkways around our back steps. And then we later on hired someone to build a deck for us out there and put some concrete closer to the house. And I discovered afterward that what these people we had hired had done is they took all the crummy wood that had already begun to mildew and rot away because we had not treated it. And they actually used that wood to build the foundation of the deck. And they bought some really nice looking, high quality wood and put on top and around it. And when we came back, we weren't there when they were doing the construction. When we came back, we were impressed. We paid the gentleman and he left. And then later on, I began to look more closely and I discovered that what he had done is he had taken very inferior quality materials to build the foundation and hammered it up and made it look really good. And I was furious. And that's what's going on here. The real structure, behind the veneer was rotten wood, a weak wall, a tottering wall, and it only made to be look good by a veneer. And this is what Paul is using as an image for these Jewish leaders. Ananias was like this tottering wall in which on the outside it had a whitewash, a white plaster. It looked good on the outside, but the internal structure lacked any strength, lacked any mortar that held those stones together. That's the language that Paul is using. It comes from Ezekiel chapter 13, verses 10 through 12. And Paul is evoking that same image here. Now, interestingly, Paul's words were actually prophetic. We mentioned a moment ago that at the end of his life, Ananias was actually taken by Jewish freedom fighters and put to death. So these words of God striking you seem to be almost prophetic as we come to the end of Ananias' life. But let's return to our story here. Verse 4, Acts chapter 23, verse 4. Those who were standing near Paul said to him, "You dare to insult God's high priest." Verse 5, Paul replied, "Brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest. For it is written," and this is Paul quoting Exodus chapter 22, "For it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people." Now, there's a variety of ways this has been taken or understood. Some have seen this as Paul recognizing that he had made a big mistake, and that when he had lashed out in anger against the high priest and he was called on that, he apologized. He realized that according to the book of Exodus, he should not have done that, and that he was responding in anger, and the words of Paul are to be understood in terms of an apology. And that's a very good and proper way to take this passage. But others have said, you know, Paul may be just using a little bit of sarcasm here. The real intention of his words may be, hey, listen, you haven't been acting like a high priest. from Paul's perspective and from the Jewish perspective. You're not acting like a high priest. Why should I recognize you as such when you're so totally out of character? And again, Paul quotes this passage from Exodus chapter 22 about showing respect to the leaders of the people. Do not speak evil about the rulers of the people. And that phrase itself can be interpreted a couple of ways. Again, it could be part of Paul's apology about, you're right, even though I may not like you as a person, I must respect your office, and therefore I apologize. I spoke in anger. I spoke wrongly. But it's also been understood maybe Paul is not referring to the high priest by quoting Exodus 22, but he's actually referring to Jesus. Jesus is the real ruler of the people. And in essence, what he's saying here is, I didn't realize you were the high priest. It's written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. Maybe Jesus, in Paul's reference here, is the ruler of the people. And because the high priest had not respected the true ruler of the people, Jesus, that he could not or should not expect the recognition that he wanted. The next few verses, one of my favorites in the whole book of Acts. In fact, I'm just going to read it today. We'll talk about it tomorrow. It's a very fun passage. So I'm going to just introduce it today, and then we will pick up our story next week with these next couple of verses. So again, the scene here, Paul addressing the Sanhedrin, talking about how he has acted in good conscience before God to this very day. The high priest orders that he be struck. Paul lashes out by saying, may God strike you. And then, verse 6, again, while I'm just going to read this passage, one of my favorites in the whole book of Acts. Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. And the story goes on from there, and we'll address that next time. But I love this notion there. Seeing this mixed crowd of people, he says, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection. Next week we'll talk about how that statement was such a strategic statement on the part of the Apostle Paul, getting to the heart of his hope and also getting him out of a bit of a scrape and confrontation before the Sanhedrin. Let's pray. Father, we thank you so much. We thank you so much for your blessings of the Scriptures and how the Scriptures give us encouragement and direction and hope as we continue walking beside the Apostle Paul as he stands trial and stands accused for his faith and his preaching on Jesus. Let us likewise be encouraged and strengthened as we see the Apostle Paul standing firm in his conviction, his good conscience, and his desire to let Jesus be known. As we continue to walk with the Apostle Paul, help us likewise to have the same boldness and confidence and hope. We pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.